say it. It's a little overwhelming, I think, at the beginning of like meeting all the houses. I wasn't sure I was really gonna keep them all straight, to be honest. There's just a lot of names and like faces that get thrown onto you. And I was having trouble putting like names to faces, this and that. Fortunately or unfortunately, they start dying off pretty quickly. And so you get narrowed down to a few important characters.
I mean, I was going to say, it's a little bit frustrating because I was going to say, well, you know, it's like the president's staff and president is missing, right? You know, you don't need to memorize most of these people. But in fact, each of them does end up playing a fairly pivotal role in the story at one or another time.
Certainly a lot of them do.
Yeah, a lot of them do. Coronabeth, I think, isn't as important as doesn't end up being as important as we thought.
Coronabeth is just really hot, and Gideon is like, OMG, Coronabeth.
Oh yeah. That's
it is a running theme that Gideon is a simp.
Yes.
Like very easily and very quickly, Gideon will like just like simp for random women. Which is fun.
Yeah, there's value in that.
But yeah, let me see.
There is,
you have like from the first house, you have like the priesthood of Canaan House, you have teacher, and like these different like sort of monk fellows who like hang around and like have this like sort of weird disposition to them. They're like, welcome to the house, and you can tell there's some like weird shit about them, and there would definitely be some like slightly off-key music playing as teacher smiles. You know, you have the second house, which is like the second house is like the emperor's sword, and you have Judith and Marta, and those characters, they don't really matter.
Yeah, they're basically like the second house is essentially West Point, and these characters are, you know, they're military and bearing, and they're buttoned up, and it's not a big deal.
They show up like sometimes to be like, you're breaking the rules. So yeah, whatever. You have the third house, which the third house is like, what's their, I'm going to be honest, the distinctions between the houses are a little lost on me for most of it.
Yeah. And like, there's spaces where there's like allusions to the various traits of the house. Like, you know, from page 72 here, yes, the house of the third will of course push the boundaries. Of course they would. And the house of the seventh, well, it's well known. A character will say, oh, you know, you're rushing into this, don't be so forth, right? You know, and so there are elements of
the third this, house is the yeah. mouth of the emperor,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's like so that's like why it's that, but it's like, and they have different like powers sometimes, like it talks about like a different schools of sorcery. I don't think they're all that well defined most of the time.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's spaces where that allude to, you know, the different dispositions, the different skills, the different histories, roles of these houses, right? But it's not, you know, I mean, I do tend to agree with the post that says, well, locked tomb houses should replace Hogwarts houses, right? In terms of, oh, you know, what are you, right? I accept that the locked tomb houses are the superior option, but they require a little more investment from the reader and the community. You know, they're not as the definition there is not as front loaded as with, you know, Gryffindor et al.
I mean, like, I don't know, like, define like the difference in the house that is the emperor's strength, the house that is the emperor's sword, and the house that is the emperor's like wardens. Like,
yeah,
they all just sound like warrior houses. And I understand the characters are different. The book doesn't actually like stress too much the difference between the houses. I wish I understood it a little better, actually. Like, I'm not really criticizing the book too much on that. But let me see. What else? There's the characters, the third house. You have the twins, Coronabeth, and is it Ianth?
Ianthi?
Ianthi. They're twins, and Ianthi's a weird little, Coronabeth's gorgeous. Ianthi is a weird little freak. And they're both accompanied by Nibirius, their pompous cavalier who's obsessed with Coronabeth.
I mean, I'd be pompous too if I had a fucking dope name like Nibirius.
Yeah, his name Nibirius. He's good at fighting, and he has like perfect hair, like every single time. You have the fourth house with its Isaac and Jeanne Mary. Is it Jeanne Mary? But they're
Jeanne Mary, yeah.
They're described as the shitty teens, which I like.
It's that it's that sort of, you know, it's that energy of, okay, you're 18 and you're 19 and you're looking down on, like, you know, the 14, 15 year olds that you were scant years ago, right?
Yes. Then you have the fifth house, Abigail and Magnus, RIP, which the Abigail and Magnus are just these sort of older, kind of more good natured, in or the first to die.
Yeah, Abigail's a historian. Magnus is, you know, he has really bad jokes, you know, to rival Gideon in badness. And he's affable and he tries to get along with everybody. And yeah, you know, unfortunately, no country for Magnuses.
Sixth house, you have Palamedes and Camilla. And these are really the characters that you're like, that are working the most with Gideon and Harrow, like in the plot. And like, Palamedes is like a necromancer of near to equal skill to Harrow. Camilla is a cavalier of near to or greater skill than Gideon. And they're much more like medically oriented. You have the, I'll skip over the seventh house for the moment, but the eighth house, this is the house of real freaks, Silas and Column. And they're basically like a house that, is obsessed with like soul sucking. In Column, the cavalier is basically just a battery for Silas, and it's a very
siphoning.
Yeah, it's a very weird relationship there. They're like uncle and cousin, or not, uncle and nephew. And then finally, I'll finally introduce the seventh house, because you have Dulcinea, Septimus, and Protesilaus. And there, Dulcinea, she is this sort of waifish, dying woman, and her like just absolutely jacked knight who like accompanies her, who looks even more uncomfortable than Gideon using a rapier.
Yes. And it must be noted, Muir really, in the explanation naming systems that she puts in the end, you know, Muir really, really does acknowledge, yeah, you know, in naming her Dulcinea, you know, I'm basically, if you've read Don Quixote, you know, something's up right away. Like she wasn't subtle about it.
Right. And you have like right off the bat, you have Gideon, like I said, Gideon's a simp. So right off the bat, Gideon falls for Corona Beth a little bit, but Dulcinea a lot. Like this sort of, because she's this, she's like so weak and beautiful, this wilting flower that's, you know, whatever, just like some poetry or whatever, which like Dulcinea is absolutely playing her, of course.
She's got like, she's got turbo cancer. And I'm actually quoting the book when I say turbo cancer.
She has turbo cancer. even more so than the book leads you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, not all's what it seems with Dulcinea, because yeah, not all's what it seems, but yeah, basically the challenge is, and it's a sort of unknown challenge from the beginning, because they're just told do what you want, whatever, in the house. But they're trying to become lictors. All of them can become lictors, presumably. But this place is full of keys and challenges, and you can get challenges from keys. You can get keys from challenges, and you can unlock rooms where long ago experiments were done to create the first lictors. And by long ago, I mean like 10,000 year plus.
Yes. And there is one rule in the house that teacher lays out, which is that you never open a locked door unless you have permission, which permission is, of course, solving these challenges.
Right. So they like get to solving these challenges, and it's like, and basically all the challenges are like kind of hinting towards the same thing. They're teaching different theorems. Like you have like the first time Gideon and Hera work together, which is when they fight against this regenerating bone construct. And you have a whole situation where, you know, you have to be able to like use soul siphoning on someone to like draw power from them to like make a shield around you. It's like, it's different, like magic things like that. It's sort of like, it exists to teach the necromancer lessons towards how to become a lictor, and basically, you know, train them up in that way. And it also exists to sort of force the necromancer and the cavalier to work closer together, which of course Gideon and Harrow being at their throat, each other's throats, as they so often are. This isn't easy. And, you know, Harrow's always trying to go off alone without Gideon, and it's leads to clashes and Gideon saying, you know, one-liners and being angry. And
at one point pulling Harrow out of like a near-death experience where she finally acknowledges, okay, I can't do this on my own.
Yeah. But like little by little, there's sort of, it's an enemies to lovers thing. You know, this is very much out of a Wattpad, you know, live journal community. This is a very popular genre, this enemies to lovers. They have, they literally have in the book, there was only one bed. It's in there. That trope, except Gideon makes a bed in the corner of the room. But
is enemies to lovers, I don't know if you know this, like, is it like specifically a very popular like queer romance trope, or is it, yes, does it just, okay, because I was thinking it might just show up because there's a lot of overlap between that and like the fan fiction like Tumblr space.
I mean, primarily, but I associate it with just fan fiction space, but like even more so with like queer like fan fiction. Yes.
Okay, why is that?
I don't know. I honestly don't. I could like theorize. I don't really know. I just know that it's like a recurring thing. But like, and it's a thing you see a lot in these spaces, and it's like, you know, it's like a fun, simple, it's not simple, but it's like, it's a fun thing to do. Like it's an interesting like inversion or whatever of like, not even of expectations, but of like a, you know, a typical story structure. And you can have a sort of will they, won't they, that like, let's, it has like a natural inborn dynamic, you know, obviously like there's a kind of a level of like accepting you have to do of, you know, the unreality of a sort of enemies to lovers situation. But like, it's fun. I'm having fun. I'm here for it. And it does like deepen their relationship a little later in the book when it like really gets into the background.
Yes.
Yeah.
The background being that Gideon didn't die.
Gideon didn't die.
We'll get into that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like how to talk through the plot, because like a lot of it's not super like really even important to what we're talking. Like, it's interesting. It's like stuff, people running around. There's like and there's like intrigue and murder and people are fighting and who killed who, but you know, so ultimately, talking about the plot in broad strokes, I almost want to just like jump to certain like character moments and stuff. I don't know. It's up. What do you think? How do you want to?
Well,
like,
yeah, because the, you know, as I said, you know, the set pieces, the character moments are very, very strong, you know, and the, I mean, not to say that you can kind of skim over the connective tissue between them, you know, because there's a lot to play with here in terms of how this world is described, in terms of how Tamsin Muir shows this off to us. Like, one of my favorite lines is actually on page 102 here. So, right, Gideon's eating in the like Canaan house, like mess hall, right? And makes a special point of noticing, oh yeah, you know, this meat is so soft that you can just like cut it with a fork. You don't even need a knife. It falls right off the bone, you know? And in the very next paragraph or a couple more paragraphs later, one of the pair was a wan knife-faced kid dressed in antiseptic whites and chainmail you could cut with a fork, you know? So immediately it's setting up this new rule by which your surroundings operate. And then the description follows that rule, right? So so you're thrown in there right off the bat, and you pick up and you're forced to adapt to it. And it's surprising, you know, how quickly you do, right? And it's very funny, of course. I mean, there's a lot going on in terms of how the prose sort of reflects the experience of being thrown into Canaan House. But, you know, part and parcel of the experience of Canaan House is that as the characters sort of unravel the mystery of the house, it's shown off to you, you, the reader. So I think right now we can say that Gideon and Harrow are the only two children from their generation. There were like a couple hundred, they all died. Literally all died, and it is explained as some toxic mold events. that contaminated the.
Or I believe they said it was a flu, right?
It was some mold. It was some mold event that I believe it's Silas from the Eighth House categorically denies could in fact kill en masse that way.
Right.
And you know he's right, but for reasons that we'll get into.
Yeah, and a lot of this is Gideon like not really being good at being fake Cavalier.
Yeah,
being good at being a Cavalier in the sense of like she can fight like Fury, like she's like when they're doing Cavalier duels, she's like easily winning. And then she has one where she fights with Nibirius where he technically wins, but then she just punches him really hard.
Which is like a violation of, you know, whatever traditional form that he subscribes to, you know.
Yeah, it's a violation of the technical rules, but she kicked his ass. So it's right. Like who won? In her mind, she certainly did. But like, so you're seeing this like it's a fish out of water situation. Gideon trying sort of for a while faking having this vow of silence, like just these like different things to get it to work, and little by little she's wearing.
What finally gets her to break that vow of silence is that it's that near-death experience, right, that Hera runs into, that Gideon and some of the other people here in Kanan House help save her from, right? Camilla was on the stairs, no warden. He said to Gideon gruffly, odds are he's still down there. Then get off your ass and help me, said Gideon Nav. So she knows that there's a hatch that Hera has disappeared under and hasn't come out. And that's what gets her to break her vow of silence, is recruiting people to save this person that's brought her here. That represents indeed her only chance to make something of herself. And it's a, you know, blink and you miss it, certainly, but it's a moment that really does illustrate the depth of Gideon's devotion, if not yet affection, to her.
Yeah, and it's like, and Gideon definitely has, like, in her own mind, doesn't seem to know exactly why she's here. In fact, there was discussion, about the, apparently the original artwork of the book was going to be identical to it was, as it was, but they discussed her having a shirt that says I'm only here for the beer on it. Like, and they decided not to go with that because they didn't want to like throw it off. But like the fact of Gideon just being who she is, being this sunglass wearing, painted up, you know, kind of phony, but not really, like as much of a phony Cavalier as she is the best Cavalier there, probably.
Yes.
One of the best. I mean, I gotta say, Camilla definitely gives her a run for her money.
And goes and, you know, holds her own in the final battle that we quite appreciated.
But like through it all, she's getting closer with Hera. They're winning each other's, you know, begrudging respect. You know, as she has to acknowledge Gideon's skill with the blade, and she's like, okay, Hera is actually pretty smart. She's actually figuring out these puzzles. She's working things out, and then like. As you get later into the novel and characters are turning on each other and, you know, after the Fifth House dies mysteriously and, you know, when characters are at each other's throats, when all of a sudden, you know, Hera starts backing her up, you have this real moment of, you have this like real moment of like, she's feels this real affection towards her and it flares, it goes down, it goes up. And I think a moment that really brings them together is I already referenced this, but there's a, and it sounds so bizarre describing it, but there's this challenge where Hera has to cross over this like zone that basically will just kill anyone who walks into it. And she has to like draw on Gideon's life force to survive it. And basically Gideon has to experience like living at the edge of death for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And just like this really horrific, brutal moment.
Right, because when Hera tries to reach into the like exclusion zone, literally her hand just decomposes and... Yeah, she has to pull it back and heal it. And yeah, so get that, but superimposed onto or redirected to Gideon.
So yeah, Gideon just like goes through all this pain for Hera, and she does it not really because like, and she says, I believe that's the scene where she's just like, well, why are you willing to do this? And she's like, because you asked. Like she just wants like this respect from Hera. And because Gideon is like, and she's like, is that the secret all the time? Like, cause yeah, Gideon's a simple person. Like she's not complicated. Like Gideon wants some basic respect. And aside from that, Gideon is here to get respect, kick ass, and hang out with hot babes. Like, that's it. Like, there's nothing. Gideon is, I'm not saying she's not a deep character, but I am saying her motivations aren't complicated. You know, like, she's a simple person who, like, has simple pleasures. And I think that is, like, what's the most enjoyable about her. And Harrow coming to realize that, like, Gideon is just a person and, like, who just wants a couple things. And unlike Harrow, has these, like, visions of greatness and these, like, this, like, feels this call to destiny. Gideon just kind of is here for the beer. Gideon is, like, in that sense, like, not, she never actually literally drinks beer, but, like, is, that's just what Gideon's here for. Gideon's here to vibe and to, like, just not be living in a tomb. She's kind of happy to do that.
Really illustrative thereof is when they're about to fight that skeleton that you mentioned, right? The giant, like, skeleton construct, yes, that seems invincible, right? Until they figure it out. So Gideon wants to go in there and fight it, right? So she can get a sense of, because Harrow has to be elsewhere, like, keeping the door open to it, right? And so, you know, Gideon, she's been using skeletons to go in there and scout, right? But Gideon volunteers to go in there. And Hera asks why. Gideon knew at this point that some really intelligent answer was the way to go. Something that would have impressed the Reverend Daughter with her mechanical insight and cunning. A necromantic answer, with some shadowy magical interpretation of what she had just seen. But her brain had only seen the one thing, and her palms were damp with the sweat that came when you were both scared and dying of anticipation. So she said, "The arms kind of looked like swords. I want to fight it." From straight from the heart, palm sweaty, mom spaghetti, you know?
There you go. I love it.
Yes. It's that incredible depth of knowledge and ambition counterposed with Gideon's very, you know, I mean, and she's not without ambition of her own, right? But it's a simpler sort of pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, her ambition was to get off world and join the military just because, like, it sounded like a thing she'd be good at doing. And she spent most of her life just kind of getting insulted and mistreated. And she just, like, wants this sort of baseline respect. And she gets it, you know, like, because she deserves it, because she is actually a very competent, cool person. So you have, like, the novel develops and the shitty teens, unfortunately, do meet their bloody end. There's a pretty brutal moment where they're down in the basement with Gideon and this just horrifying monster appears and just, like, freaking shreds them. And you have the disappearance of Dulcinea's gigantic bodyguard and then the discovery of his head. That's a pretty in Harrow's room. There's, like, a kind of a moment of, like, fake tension of, oh, did Harrow kill him? No one ever thought Harrow killed
him. No, never.
Prost or whatever. But you have this, and it's like a slowly unwinding thing as anyone could die at any moment. No one knows who's killing them. And people start fighting over keys. And, you know, it's a very, you know, Knives Out, not like the movie, but like Knives Out in the sense of, like, everybody's got their knives on each other. Like that, the term Knives Out, that's what you've got now. And everyone's at everybody's throats and everyone is kind of stressed out and no one really knows what's coming next or what could happen. And is there some dark force in this house killing everyone? Is someone murdering people? The answer is yes to both of those things. But before that happens, you have this moment where after Gideon briefly believes Harrow has killed Protocilius. You have this moment where Harrow is like, I'm going to shoot straight with Gideon. I got to talk to her about, like, secrets of my house or whatever. And so she brings her to this pool, which I've been told this pool scene, there's, like, more fan fiction or like fan art of this pool scene than, like, any scene in, like, human history.
That surprises me not at all.
But it's the two of them sitting in the pool and their, like, makeup gets, like, all washed off, all the skull makeup, and they're bloody and, like, shaking, and there's been murder and it's terrible. And then it's Harrow just like, hey, straight up, both of us, let's sit, let's talk. And Harrow's just like, listen, you know how there was like 200 kids and they all died and I was born? My parents conducted just a dark ritual, basically, to conceive me as a necromantic daughter because they could not conceive and they needed a daughter of their house to carry on the necromancer line and the dark power. And so they sacrificed 200 children's lives to create mine. And you should have died and you did not. And that terrified everyone around you. And my parents resented and feared you for that and were reminded of the horrible thing they did. And I was reminded once I learned, I was reminded by that of you as well. But I was always like told, oh, I you have 200 deaths on you. You know, you have blood on you. Like that's you have to be great. And she was the best. And she was like so great that she violated, she violated the rules of the house and went into the locked tomb and managed to survive and saw this beautiful girl who was like eternally sleeping in the locked tomb. And it made her feel strange things and this strange relationship. And it's like not exactly fleshed out exactly how she feels about it, but she knew she had to stay. And her parents, after Gideon ran, because Gideon was a shitty kid and saw Harrow do this thing and was like, oh, I'm telling, and told on Harrow to her parents. And then Harrow's parents, being the good ninth housers, committed ritual suicide, basically. And Harrow spent the rest of her life. Gideon felt that Harrow blamed her for her parents' death. And Harrow, that's not exactly correct, but Harrow felt this resentment around her parents' death and felt this resentment around Gideon's survival and felt this resentment around Gideon's sort of simple vitality while she got to be this sort of lingering figure of a lonely death. And all that combined with just sort of her weird obsession with Gideon made her like sort of treat Gideon this way her entire life. And you have this moment where Gideon's just like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And Harrow's just like, okay, you should just kill me because like, if after all that, after I treated you shittily, after whatever, you're just saying you're sorry to me. Like, no, like you have the right to take my life. Like it's like a very intense moment where Gideon just tackles her into the pool in like a hug and like gives her the only kiss she gives her in the entire book, I think.
Literally the only one. Literally the only one.
It's a really great moment. And I really do like it is a really meaningful, powerful moment, and it's written with enough rawness and enough like realness and enough, you know, silliness, even like the silliness of the feelings of these like girls who are old enough to be just out of high school. Like they're not, you know, adults really. Like they're adults, but like barely.
This book really has hammered home for me just how young 18 is.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's got all those contradictions in it, and it's a really beautiful moment. And it's far and away for me the best part of the book, no doubt. But that is like really the emotional core of it to me. Is it's just these two girls who are not at all, who are just insecure and weird in their own way, and they feel ostracized for whatever reason, and deeply insecure for various reasons, but they're sort of able to find this kinship or the not kinship, but this like closeness in each other. That's, you know, romantic, but not like obsessively. So like it doesn't really harp even too much on the relationship aspect. Obviously they're into each other, but like you just have this moment and it's, I don't know, really strong. And I really loved it a lot.
Yeah. I mean, no notes, you know, it's the perfect culmination of these two characters who had, I mean, you, as the relationship is unpacked, you know, you get a sense of why they hate each other in such a deep and abiding way. And, you know, it's because of what they don't know, you know, and it's because of what they've sort of refused to examine in themselves. To just have done with all that, you know. And I mean, the reason that it's in the saltwater pool incidentally, I believe it's just a like family lore thing, right? Because the frozen girl in the locked tomb that Harrow sees is in the middle of a moat of salt water. Is that right?
Well, the No, well, it's, I don't know what she's in the middle of, but I know the family of the ninth swore they would only discuss the secrets of the ninth if they were submerged in salt water, which was like, that lore I think was created just because it is so difficult to be submerged in salt water if you're from the ninth. So yes, it's like, it would have to be a very intentional thing. I think that's kind of the context for that. I don't know if there's more to it than that or not, but it's a great moment. And it's also this moment that like allows like this, like the fight towards the end, and like a part where there's a great part towards the end in the fight, which we'll get into, but like where they're able to defend each other so well because they know each other's weak points, because they've tried to kill each other like 30 times through the years, like probably 30 times a day through the years, mm-hmm, knowing each other.
Yeah, they never fought side by side, but yeah, they come by it absolutely naturally.
And like, yeah, there's something to say of like, of course this isn't actually like a natural relationship, and of course like there would be like, I'm not really actually that worried about like the realism of it or not.
I'm not saying these are not realistic characters, because their personalities make absolute sense, you know, but like it's, their conditions are so alien to yours and mine, you know?
Well, I read online, I was like reading reviews, and like there were some like reviews that were like, well, this would actually be an unhealthy relationship. And I'm like, okay, well, it's still interesting. Like, I don't know. I don't find that to be a very meaningful criticism.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get a lot of time to just like cuddle.
or any, really.
Really, or any, yeah. They are pretty much immediately thrown into like your sort of the final act of this, which is this this like last round of like, you know, bloody clashes. You have the second house, which has been relatively unimportant, decides they're gonna end this whole affair, and they try to call for people from off world and end up killing the teacher, the guy who's like been running the house, and all the skeletons drop. And that's where you have a moment where it's like, oh shit, like that, you know, you've entered the final act when all the skeletons kind of drop.
Yes.
And like, the house is literally falling apart. Like the magic that's holding together is deteriorating. And it's like, yeah, this house is like been creaking at the seams, but like only through like, the fact that it's there at all is still like an act of magic, and it is like a actively deteriorating magic now.
Yes. Falling apart. And at first you think, oh, it's because they've killed this load bearing priest. Right. But no, it's not teacher that's actually keeping this all together. Teacher himself. In fact, the whole class of priests of Kanan House are what are called revenants.
Yeah. They're spirits like tied to dead bodies.
Yes. And they, again, that, As we've alluded to earlier, you know, that level of necromancy that perfectly mimics life, if not recreates it, right, is a level of power that you really have to be a lictor to unlock, if not the Emperor. And indeed, there is a lictor walking among us. Well, technically two, because the third house has gotten impatient. Ianthi has figured out based on the houses piecing together the pieces of the sort of lictor theorem that are scattered around throughout the challenges, Yanthi's figured it out. She's like, okay, you have to, as a necromancer, basically devour your cavalier's soul, right? And combine yourself and them into one super being. And through this process, you can basically just feed off your cavalier's soul as this endless power source for eternity. And she tries that. She immediately does that with Nabirius, right? And gains his knowledge, his skills, his basically everything that makes Nabirius Nabirius. She now has access to, although not exactly perfectly.
Yeah, she's like, he's like kind of struggling. Nabirius is like struggling inside of her. Like she's not quite got that mastery. You have this like very tense moment where the sorcerers of the necromancer and the cavalier of the eighth try and fight with her. And she like, isn't like fully in her power, but she's still like insanely powerful and is doing this like freaky magic where she is summoning like skin walls and shit. It is like a really like weird visceral scene where she eventually kills these two like freaks from the eighth house, which I'm like happy to see them go. There's some weirdos. I did not like those guys. I thought they were interesting. I was happy to see them die.
They're set up. I mean, the way they're introduced, right, in that first sort of scene earlier in the book where Gideon meets them in the mess hall, right? It's you think they're gonna be like more of villains than they are. But
like,
no,
they are, but they're not like
they know there's some weird fuck shit going on, but they don't have a full picture of it.
They're threats, but they're like there's even a scene where they're like threatening Gideon, but then they end up fighting each other instead. Like they're I wouldn't call them fake out bad guys. Like they're not fake out bad guys. They are bad guys. They do pose a threat. They just simply are not the greatest threat. And it's like the thing of like where the villain from season one of a show gets like, you see the villain from season five, just like kill the villain from season one in like two hits or something.
Oh yes. The Ruby effect.
It's kind of that, like, it's kind of like, I don't know. It's kind of like how it's, Ra's al Ghul from season three of Arrow, like just disarming Malcolm Merlyn in like two hits, which is like an incredibly niche reference, but showing just, oh, it's gotten that real, you know, like you thought season one was crazy. You thought this guy was bad. No, this guy's crazy. That's kind of the setup you've got going here. And then you have this big reveal, which like, I don't know, if you didn't know something weird was going on with Dulcinea, I don't know what to tell you. You this must be your first rodeo, but something weird was going on with Dulcinea. She was not all she appeared to be. She was not really just some weakling. It turns out, in fact, Dulcinea never set foot in this house. In fact, it was her ancestor, Cytherea. Is that right? Cytherea?
Kithorea.
It's Kithorea. Are you sure it starts with a hard, it's a hard K?
Kithorea, yes.
You look it up or?
Yeah, it's in the back.
Darn it. I'm seeing that my preparation, my lack of preparation is showing here.
Well, because why would anybody have guessed that?
Yeah, it's fine. Kithorea, who is the ancestor of Dulcinea. No one had really seen Dulcinea. No one knew what she looked like. These people all communicated with just like letters and stuff. It's actually weirdly, just like as a side note before we really launch into this, it's a weirdly low-tech world for them having spaceships.
Yeah, they fight with, you know, they fight with rapiers, short swords, you know, finger claws, not outright guitars.
There seems to be there's no like allusion to a Dune like technology, which like, do you know why they use swords in Dune?
Why is that?
Because in the Dune universe, technology's progressed to the point where they've made personal force fields that like can deflect bullets. And it moves, that deflects anything that moves fast, that moves incredibly swiftly and can deflect like energy blasts. So only like certain types of like weapons, like martial weapons, can pierce through the shields. So they all have like a revert back. And of course it's like Frank Herbert is like just wants to use swords and found a reason to, but it's like an interesting enough reason. This world, and I'm not criticizing it. The author wants to use swords. And so she used swords. Swords are cool. But it is interesting that there's not really even a pretension of like why they use swords. In fact, guns show up in the book, but are never used. Like it's just like, oh, look, it's an ancient gun. And the characters know what guns are, but like nobody seems to use them. When they talk about communication from each other, they talk about, you know, letters, like writing letters to each other. But they do have like presumably, if not faster than light travel, then, you know, incredibly, incredibly swift travel. That said, they are like not traveling between like galaxies or even between solar systems. So I guess the space shuttles don't need to necessarily be all that like further developed than we have in our world, but it's still like an interesting dynamic.
We don't really have a full picture of the Empire, right?
Not at all.
There are a couple of allusions to like border worlds and colonies. And at one point, you know, one character mentions that, oh yeah, you know, my dad got blown up on by insurgents on this hold planet, which we're never told what a hold planet is really, but there's just enough that you can kind of infer. You know, there's something going on that has drawn the Emperor's attention to worlds beyond. And that is why Kithareya has sort of come in disguise as Dulcinea. That is why she has set this series of murders into motion. It's because she's trying to bait the Emperor back to Kanan House. As it happens, she's not the only... She's one of the Emperor's original lictors, right? So she's had 10,000 years to get this whole lictor thing down.
And it's worth noting that she has the same disease that Dulcinea had, that she died of, which is this basically like this strange blood, this like blood cancer thing that's going on. And it's she, by becoming a lictor, did not get cured of cancer, but rather could not die from it. And so she's just sort of lived with this horrific chronic illness, like on the edge of death for 10,000 years, which is of course as horrifying as it sounds. You know, she started as like the sweetest of all of them, the best heart of all of them. But 10,000 years of pain will do a number on the old brain.
Oh yeah. 10,000 years of pain. And you know, she has her cavalier, of course, her soul imprisoned within her. So, you know, you have two people's worth of unimaginable pain, you know,
it's worth noting. She doesn't seem to have resolved with her cavalier in absorbing
mm-hmm.
the cavalier either. There's this like, it's not stated explicitly, but she has this like line of like, oh, I had to burn my cavalier for several hundred years before the cavalier was absorbed, versus like the absorption of a cavalier can happen much more naturally and much more like painlessly, I think, if the cavalier is like down with it. Because you've seen Iberius resisting, right?
Yes.
Versus in a minute when we see another lictor happening much more smoothly and with much less pain. And so I think there is like an element of like that resistance that's happening too. Did you get that read?
Kithareya, of course, has much less resistance going on than Ianthe.
No, I think she did though. Like, I think that was, there was like an implication of that as part of like what fucked her up.
Well, yes, there's part of that. But also, you know, I mean, she doesn't have what Gideon and Harrow end up having, because that's what happens, right? Kithareya is fighting Gideon and Harrow and Palamedes Sextus gets murked right away. She's fighting Camilla as well. She's basically 3v1ing, 4v1ing once Ianthe jumps back into the fight.
You have a really fun battle scene here.
This
giant bone construct that murked the shitty teens. And you have like Harrow and Gideon working together to like beat the thing. But they're fighting this, like they're fighting essentially like a god, small g god, but still like they're fighting like a truly titanic power, like a self-regenerating, unbelievably intelligent, has the knowledge and strength of multiple people in her, all this sorcery, all this magic. I mean, you name it, she can do it. Person of this, and they are, you know, at the end of the day, they're just doing their best fighting it. And you really feel like they're really getting like knocked around, and it's an element of like, if we're gonna go down, we're gonna go down fighting, you know.
And even
go down side by side.
And even Harrow, with, you know, Harrow is literally like 200 people in one, like the death energy of 200 children coalesce into one being, right? And as powerful as that is, you know, Kithareya is on a whole different level. And ultimately, what they have to do is they have to enter into that lictor relationship. And Gideon actually offers herself up willingly.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, Gideon, like Harrow would not have asked for it, but Gideon throws herself down on a spike saying for the ninth, which is notable because she hated the ninth. But and she actually has a moment where Gideon's like, go back to the ninth. And she's like, I don't care about the ninth. I care about you. But she'll say for the ninth for the sake of Harrow.
Yes, is, yes, and the prospect of, you know, Gideon wasting her life energy, her thallergy or thanergy is so. There's thallergy and thanergy. We're what, like an hour and a half into this episode, and we're only just now explaining the magic system. I mean, to the extent that it really matters, right?
I don't feel like I have a good enough grasp of the magic system to explain it.
Yeah, there's thallergy and thanergy, right? And one is life and one is death. Thanergy is death. And that is the value in having people that aren't necromancers, right? Is because if you're a necromancer, there's no like dead people in space. Necromancers have to be somewhere where something has died or they have to be near Earth that has become a repository for something dead. They can't do necromancy in space. And of course, when you have that limitation, the first thing you do, of course, is you break it. So the necromancer, right? The lictors, right? The Necrolord Prime and the lictors, those are the sort of people who can do necromancy in space. Everybody else, no. But yes, so it's the prospect of that power that Gideon represents, right? That possibility of Hera devouring her soul and then becoming a single being, right? It's the prospect of losing that baits Hera into going through with it.
Absolutely. And once she's ascended to lictorhood, you know, you have Gideon speaking in her ear, showing her how to use the sword as her soul fades away, getting a few more snarks in, of course. Calling her sugar lips, I believe. And then Hera is like pretty handily defeats Kithorea after this ascension to lictorhood. Like, she pretty quickly is like, oh, like, here we go. And then she basically takes Kithorea apart. And you have sort of the book ending in this place where Hera is absolutely devastated. She's got everything. She got what she wanted. She got what she pursued. More than her parents could have ever dreamed in, you know, creating her. Because, like, her parents did not create her with the prospect of, like, her, she might become a lictor. They made her just so the house would survive one more generation. So she's surpassed as a necromancer, as a member of the ninth, as just a person, the wildest expectations of her house.
But at the cost of everything that she didn't know she really wanted.
Precisely. Yes, exactly. And at the end of the day, there's only two people left standing, and it's her and it's Ianthe, who is down one arm but remains alive as the other lictor. Every single other person is dead in the entire house, Gideon included. And
Camilla has fucked off somewhere.
Oh, yeah, Camilla. I thought for some reason Camilla got like incinerated. So Camilla did live.
It's not stated explicitly whether she did or not in.
I guess it didn't say whether Corona Beth died or not either.
Yeah.
Okay, so Corona Beth and Camilla may be out there somewhere. MIA. Ianthe and Hera is still alive. Everyone else dead. And you have her, like, you have the Emperor who has arrived, and he's a very plain looking guy. Except for just pure black eyes. And he just says, like, I need you to help me. Like, there's like big stuff coming. And I genuinely, he's like, I'm God and that's not enough.
Yes. It's the Dark Souls thing of, okay, all the other gods have either died or disappeared or gone insane. And that's the other lictors.
And that's like where the novel leaves off. And it leaves off in a very, you know, it's a place that makes me want to know more, no doubt. I do think it wraps itself up nicely. Like, I don't think it doesn't function as a singular. I mean, I wouldn't feel comfortable talking about it if I didn't think it functioned as a singular piece of fiction.
Oh, it's a brilliant tragedy. Yeah.
Yeah. It works as like an arc. If that was the end and there wasn't a sequel, I would be like, damn, I want to know what happens next. But I wouldn't be like, wow, it failed as like a book. Like, I think it works quite well. It closes its arc out. It finally ends not from Gideon's perspective, notably. But kind of from Gideon's perspective, because Gideon is now, you know, one with Hera. That doesn't mean Gideon can always talk in Hera's ear necessarily. Because she kind of fades away in the first few minutes. But she is like part of Harrow now. And the next book is Harrow the Ninth, and presumably is from Harrow's perspective. But
and here's where and here's where it kind of clicked for me when we were discussing earlier, right? You know, this sort of unique perspective that you have recounting the events of this book with occasional intrusions of, you know, somebody saying this was obviously mysterious as hell, right? Somebody interjecting with Tumblr speak, right? Apparently pizza exists in this universe, right? She describes her mild allergy to face paint. Gideon does as pizza face, right? And you get such a blend of perspectives, perhaps only from a reverend daughter combined with a sunglasses wearing cavalier.
Right. And that's what allows it to work. And it's very interesting, and it makes for an interesting reread as well.
I tell you what, fucking early in the book, right, when they're about to leave the locked tomb, right? Where is it? As they pull themselves into the shuttle, the door mechanism sliding down with a pleasingly final wonk, she, Gideon, leaned into Harrow. Harrow, who was dabbing her eyes with enormous gravity, the necromancer flinched outright. "Do you want?" Gideon whispered huskily. "My hanky? I want to watch you die." "Maybe, Nonagesimus," she said with deep satisfaction. "Maybe, but you sure as hell won't do it here." That hits different.
Yeah, no. Indeed.
Knowing what we know now.
Indeed, it hits different. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm just thinking about, like, you know, the book as a whole. And I really do, and thinking about, like, you know, I don't have a whole lot to say about this book politically. It's so far removed from our world. It's very far removed from most, like, even analogies to our world. So I'm not really even going to, like, make a point on that front. I think it is an interesting look at, though, a developing trends in, like, you know, popular fiction. I think it represents a fiction informed by the internet, which is a fiction which is going to be all the fiction written from here on out, presumably, unless something very strange happens, akin to Dark Ages from President is Missing. It represents all the, really, I think, the best of that in a lot of ways, of these cultures, these niche, you know, cultures that have managed to exist in different corners of the internet, of built by, you know, people who did not feel accepted in their own spaces, their own homes, their own schools, their own what have you, but were able to, like, come to this sort of place on the internet and exist in, like, fan communities and in chat rooms, and, like, built this culture that, and is you know, much can and has been said about it, but has, like, informed a new generation of writers in a very interesting way. And I would say that of all the books I've read that feel very informed by the internet, I enjoyed this one probably the most of any I've read. For the most part, books that I feel that are very informed by online culture tend to not be very good. They tend to just lean into, like, whatever the Twitter drama was at the time of writing or something. Do some of the meme references land flat? Yes. Does it have some, like, moments that feel ripped right out of, like, a Marvel movie where, like, it's like a tense moment happens and the character says, "That just happened"? It might literally happen in the book for all I know. It definitely could. Yes, it has that. It also has this this cross genre feel that you know, fan fiction tends to bring. It also has this language of communication that feels, you know, uniquely spawned from, like, this sort of blogosphere, this sort of, like, Tumblr space. It feels uniquely situated to sort of be received and molded by fans. Like, you can tell while she's writing it, she has this, like, even for very minor characters, has this like affinity for them because she knows there's someone out there who will have this affinity for them. In fact, she has a quote I really liked about it, about the book, which she said, quote, "I hope my fandom is writing long, serious epics and writing parody pieces that make me look stupid in weird porn and ships that I never saw coming," end quote. And you feel that through it as well. And you, of course, feel the own your own experiences of the author in it, you know, and it all comes together to make something that's, you know, undeniably contemporary, undeniably unique, undeniably imperfect, but something I did really genuinely enjoy. And I found it to be quite refreshing to read.
Especially after fucking President is Missing.
Especially after another very contemporary book that in a different way is informed by the internet. We didn't really talk too much about how it's informed by the internet, but that was just informed by Twitter anxiety. President.
Yes, 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 it was, you know, and this is the opposite of Twitter anxiety, right? This is Twitter euphoria. This is Tumblr euphoria, you know?
Yeah.
And again, we were discussing this earlier, right? It's a book that I think it doesn't live and die by its fandom engagement, certainly, but I think for the sort of person who reads Locked Tomb Houses as like a very necessary substitute for Hogwarts houses in this day and age, it does a lot of heavy lifting, right? If you're part of this fandom that's actively participating in building this sort of expanded universe, right? In, you know, perhaps RPing as like Necromancer and Cavalier, like as if, you know, you're in one or another of these houses. Because again, what do you get but snatches of allusion, the barest allusions to the culture and the demeanor of one or another house, right? It's something that is it's scattered before you in pieces and you kind of have to pick it up and assemble it yourself. And again, you know, does that make it any less than does it make it any less than like a hypothetical version of this book where the houses were fleshed out a little more explicitly? Absolutely not. You know, it's a different way of engaging with the media, right? It's a different way of engaging with this particular work. It's accessible perhaps in a very different way to somebody like you or somebody like me who's coming to Gideon the Ninth as an outsider.
We're not like Tumblr lesbians. We're just right. Not. We are not a 17-year-old fan fiction writing like lesbian on Tumblr, which is what this book was explicitly written for. That doesn't mean we don't appreciate it, but we are not the target explicitly.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, you know, not to do a one-to-one comparison, but you know, I mean, we're not the target audience for fucking Shakespeare, right? And you know, those plays are still considered timeless and you know, as close to objectively good stories as you can, as I think you can say something is. You know,
I think there's something to be said for the speed with which things like pop culture references come and go in like internet culture, that will definitely influence things that are like contemporary references in a period piece. Like, it's hard for me to imagine if I wrote a book today and it was published in 6 months that any of the references would be considered anything but outdated memes if I put memes in it. So there is like a conversation to have about that for sure when you're like comparing it with other things that reference like modern day events. But like the comparison isn't, you know, without point. Like there is, you know, books are going to reference things of their time. I have like a, and I don't know what the proper line to walk is on it. I don't know how many pop culture references is too many. I don't know if I just am like burnt out enough on like Marvel movies that I am just having a knee jerk reaction to any like, you know, snarky one liner. when I like have those things. And it's like a thing that I've like had to examine. And like, I had an initial, like very strong reaction to some of the lines in the book where I was like, oh my God, this is stupid. This takes me out of it. And then I thought, A, I'm not the target audience. B, like, okay, these references are going to happen in everything. They do happen in everything. I mean, she makes the point about Gilbert and Sullivan, and she's right. And I appreciate her being like, yeah, they're dumb and outdated, and it's what I wanted to put in my book. So I put them there because it's how it's the culture from which she's emerging. She's not emerging from like a writer's school. She's not emerging from like necessarily a literary tradition in which she participated or a salon or something. She's emerging from the tradition of Wattpad writers, you know, that's just where she's coming from, and she's being true to it.
And isn't Tumblr perhaps a salon all its own?
I'm not giving it that. No. The Tumblr, that's for a different podcast to break down whatever that thing is. But it's certainly, you know what it has done? It's certainly produced a lot of very interesting cultures and subcultures and subcultures and niche stuff and memes and arguments and debates that no doubt historians will look back on this time and try to, you know, resolve, and they'll try to figure out, was Gideon the Ninth, you know, there'll be debates, you know, they'll be using Gideon the Ninth as a sort of Rosetta Stone to understand the memes and references of our time, you know, which I can only hope that you and I figure out some sort of lictor like magic so that we can from the future view people try to decipher Gideon the Ninth. And when they ask us for help, we will refer them to this episode. We'll cross millions of views, but not 4 millions of years.
It'll be this episode and Gideon the Ninth and perhaps Homestuck etched into a slab somewhere.
If Homestuck is etched into a slabs, I don't have a good comeback to that. I wish you could see my face right now. Homestuck etched into a slab. I think, like, I don't know what face I'm making right now, but it's something between horrified and curious. That's for sure.
It'll happen.
Doesn't everything happen eventually in the wide universe?
Yes, you know, it's infinite monkeys animating infinite Flash cartoons.
And, you know, to bring it full circle to the joke at the very beginning, what is 200 monkeys dead making a Spotify brain jack to the infinite monkeys that are typing on infinite typewriters? So at the end of the day, the sacrifice is worth it for our brain jack episodes coming in 2090, we'll say 2900 20 XDX.
Let's leave open some room for, you know, great leaps of technology or sudden dark ages.
Yeah, something like that. Whether there'll be two suns in the sky, three suns in the sky, no suns in the sky, that kind of thing.
It's a matter of perspective.
Well, speaking of perspective, I'll try to do a segue here. Do you have any, what's your, you know, takeaway thoughts or takeaway perspective on Gideon the Ninth?
If somebody hates you and repeatedly states their intent to kill you, it means they love you.
If, you know, normally that wouldn't be true, but if the person could control dark magic, death is really not that big a deal. You know, if you're a necromancer threatening to kill someone, that's not that serious, really.
Yeah, death is a tool like any other.
Yeah. If you think about it, that's, you know, that's, it's basically, it's playful banter, essentially. At the end of the day, so at the end of the day, don't look to the sky. Don't look towards, okay, I've got a political takeaway. Don't join the military. Get a goth girlfriend instead. That's 100%. The message of Gideon the Ninth. It's, you shouldn't join the military. That's bad. In fact, it's better to get a goth GF.
And not one of those goth GFs that the military is actively trying to thirst trap people with.
No. You need an anti-imperialist goth GF.
Yeah, that's just non-negotiable.
That's how we'll win people over to socialism. Anti-imperialist goth girlfriends.
See, the only way to beat a bad guy with a thirst trap is a good guy with a thirst trap.
Now I'm remembering the 2020 wars of hot girls for Bernie versus hot girls for Trump. Do you remember that?
No, I somehow missed all that.
You don't. I mean, the hashtag still exists, I'm sure, but it was just it was basically like internet personalities posting attractive pictures of themselves and saying, I'm for Bernie, I'm for Trump, I'm for whoever. And then there was hot girls for Biden, and there was like five people who used that hashtag.
Of course there fucking was.
It was a weird time. 2020 was a weird time. Speaking of internet culture, holy cow.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, what a turning point, and yet not.
You know, it repeats, and much like the great upheaval of 10,000 years ago in this, it feels like it's been 10,000 years, and in 2024, we'll, you know, the second battle will happen, and I'm trying to come up with an analogy here. The enemy he could defeat once, but not twice. Maybe there'll be something there. I don't know. We'll see. Let's hope not. All right, listeners. Well, we really appreciate it. This has been probably even more scatterbrained episode than usual. Or I guess couple of episodes, but you know, hopefully you enjoyed it. And I definitely recommend this book. I know if you've listened to this episode at this point, we've like thoroughly spoiled it. But it's still a lot of fun. It's atmospherically really interesting. It reads really smoothly despite being like fairly long. Characters are a lot of fun, and I'm excited to see more out of this author. I'm excited to see this Western sci-fi that she's writing. I'm on board for it, and I will also be reading the rest of these books. So
yeah, I'm 100% there for it, you know. And presumably, if we seemed a little scatterbrained, you know, presumably it'll be a little more focused when one of us eats the other's soul, you know, and then we can just like record for hours and hours and hours, days even, right?
Who is the Cavalier and who is the Necromancer? I'm not really sure.
I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, that would be an interesting dynamic if there was somebody that they were both Cavaliers and both Necromancers and then they consumed each other. I don't know. Now I'm writing fan fiction.
It has to have been
done. See how it goes? See how it's created? So it mm-hmm. goes. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. All right, folks. Well, appreciate you listening. As always, if you enjoy the show, you know, let somebody know, or at the very least, if you're going to be hanging out with your friends, trying to solve like some mystery, if you've got some downtime, don't use it to duel other Cavaliers. There's no point in that. Pop on an episode of Socialist Shelf, you know, unwind while you're trying to solve algorithms and super theorems to become a lictor. And if you do become a lictor, you know, We could certainly use your support, that's for sure.
Lictor.
I give some secrets.
Lictor? I'd barely know her.
I'm so true, so true. I'm always saying this. All right, folks. See you later. Bye.
Peace out.